I don't know where this is going. Really. My name is Tom Downey, and I'm a recovering alcoholic. Hi. I want to thank Kevin and the group for asking me. Somebody had their hand up. You're excused. I thanked the group, didn't I? You'll have to help me. Statistics. I came to the program when I was 36, after 18 years of alcoholic drinking. If I stay without a drink until April the 27th, I'll have 50 years in. We might say that what I'm going to speak about is how it works. And speaking about longevity, they asked an old Irishman who was in his middle 80s how he happened to have such good health and what he attributed it to. And he thought for a minute and he said, I think it's because I never drank or smoked or kissed a girl until I was 10 years of age. Back when I come in, willpower was still in vogue. And this is an old story, but they talked about the man and wife. She had been on him for about 10 years to use his willpower about this drinking. And he had shunted her and shunted her and shunted her. You know how drunks do. Well, she finally had enough of it. He had went one step too far. And she said, for instance, you never used your willpower, and I'd like to have you use a couple of examples. She says, there's Goldberg down the street. He smoked for 30 years. And he had an attack, and he took him to the hospital. And the diagnosis was that if he didn't quit smoking, that he was going to die in short time. And what did he do? He used his willpower. That's what he did. He quit smoking. She said, Ginsburg was drunk for 25 years. He also had an attack, and they took him to the hospital. And they told him if he didn't quit drinking, he'd be dead in 6 months. And what did he do? He quit drinking. He used his willpower. Well, this fellow had been listening to this for about 10 years, and he said, it's willpower you want? He said, I'll show you willpower. He said, I'm going to be sleeping in the guest room from now on. About 6 months went by. One night he woke up. There was a shaking at the end of the bed. And he looked down there, and there was his wife. He said, what do you want? She thought, I just thought maybe you'd like to know that Goldberg smoking again. I came to Columbus. I was sober 19 years. I'd been living in Chicago, and I moved into Reynoldsburg in a brand new apartment complex just south of Main Street on Briarcliff, I believe it was. And the reason I remember the date is because it was November the 13th, and that's my birthday. And so everything went great, and I had enough time, and I called the downtown office at 555 East Broad, and a fella answered, and I asked him where there was a meeting, and he told me Whitehall. They met at, close there to Holy Spirit at that time, and I thanked him, and about 8 o'clock, I strolled into the meeting, and a fella come up to me, and he said, "Are you Tom Downey?" Well, I hadn't said anybody that I was even in town, so I was amazed. And he saw the surprise, and he said, "Well, I was the fella that answered the phone downtown." He took me over and introduced me to Jack Ditter. He realized that I had moved into an apartment I was on the third floor, and on the third floor I could look right down into Jack's kitchen. Yeah, there wasn't hardly any trees there. And so Jack and I and Mary became close friends, and Joe, he lived about 5 doors down from Jack. And less than 30 days later, I met Bob Nine, Brother Joe, Tom Wine, Bob Carpenter, not yet, Joe, not yet. And the first week in December, we started Friendship. And there I met Paul Blackburn, Joe again, Russ Cameron, Luke Devine, who else?
Ben
Bodie. Yes, Ben Bodie. I mentioned Bob. Is he still alive? Does he still live in Florida? How about that? But Brother Joe was a real example of a helpmate for AA. He had a, if I recall right, he had a group on Fifth Avenue, a church there, and they built this new church there where Friendship is. And he insisted that Bob Nine get him an AA group, if I remember correctly. Now, Bob Nine and I, without realizing it, had some old friends in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And so in reminiscing, we got to know each other pretty well and became good friends. And I can remember one of the times, we both knew a barber in Fort Wayne in the 1950s that was sort of the Mr. AA in Fort Wayne at that time. And he was a great guy. But Bob Nine asked me one time whether I knew what the LSOPR was. And I said, no, I don't know what that is. He said, "You never heard of that?" And I want you folks that belong to that to excuse me, but he said, "That's an Al-Anon phrase." And that, whatever them initials were, they call that the Little Sisters of Perpetual Revenge. And when I come in, it really was something like that. See, Al-Anon didn't start until 1952, although there was a lot of, I can recall a fellow still living. He came from the Dayton area, and he's been in a couple of years less than I, but I heard him speak in Sydney, about a year or so ago, and he was saying about how he had this problem for a long time, and they didn't know anybody in AA, but they knew about AA, and they lived about three blocks from where the meeting was, and it got so bad that his wife said, let's go down and go to one of those meetings. And they went down and went to those one of those meetings, and when they walked in, and this is true, at that time the women sat on one side and the men sat on another. It was normal in every meeting that I went to for some time. And he said we went to that first meeting, and every time a point would come up, the speaker would get it. Why, she'd kick him. And this went on for about 3 weeks, until one night when he went in there, he tumbled. Why, those women sat on this side and the men sat on that side. That's a joke, folks. What is the three requisites? What happened? How it was, what happened, and how it is now. I don't do very good with that anymore for some reason. 18 years of drinking and almost 50 years of sobriety, I don't know how to put it together in about 30 or 40 minutes anymore. And I was born and raised in Lima, Ohio. Had my first drink when I was about 13 or 14. In those days, the folks usually had card parties in their home. And it was bootlegging in those days, and I come from a father who was a one-drink man. He had a soft spot in his heart for drunks, but not in his own family. And I used to sit in when one of the older folks had to go to the can, and I got my first drink. It was a highball, and I thought it was great. Now, I didn't drink from that time on until I was 18, very little. At 15, I joined the Guard. The Guard was in ill repute at that time, and they couldn't get people. And a friend of my sister's was a straight arrow, and the captain of the outfit was a straight arrow. But I hate to tell you about the rest of the Guard. But anyway, I was 15 years old, I weighed 105 pounds, and the requisites was much greater in those. You had to be 18 and 125, I believe. So I looked like a Boy Scout, and I got a picture. And I looked like a Boy Scout amongst all those old tarantlers. Really. And I was in a year, and I was the only one that could type, so I became company clerk, and I had a sidearm. And so we went to Camp Perry, and they were going to show the kid the town, Toledo. So they took me to Toledo, and I drank with them all night, and we got back at 4 in the morning, and it didn't affect me. Now, I didn't know nothing about capacity or anything like that, and I didn't really feel, I felt the drinks, but not to the extent. And they were amazed. And so I became one of the boys, and I was able to take I and the first sergeant slept in one tent by ourselves. And in there we had a big cabinet, and they had a gallon of booze in there. And I was allowed to drink from that time on. Now, I didn't drink because there was no money. At 18, I went to New York, and I found that New York was just a great place. I was so amazed at you know, and I was just a country boy, you might say, but I was amazed at all the things that were going on. You know, like the subway was a nickel, and I could ride it all night. And I did. I thought it was great. I had an uncle that lived in Jersey, and he was the guy that got me up there, and I was supposed to get a job, and the job fell through. I met two other fellows and young guys. One looked younger than I did. And I'll never forget, he was about, I was 18 and he was 26. And we heard that you could go to the Siemens Institute and get a flop and two meals. Now this is 32, for nothing. And we went down and they allowed us in there. One of the fellows had some discharges and I was supposed to get a job, so they let us stay there. Now in those days, from the battery all the way up to the Siemens Institute was, say, like 6 blocks, and it was all sort of park-like. And every day, there you couldn't see the grass for the seamen that were on the beach there, as they called it. And they said that there was 10,000 seamen on the beach in New York, and 5,000 didn't have a nickel in their pocket. We got, I better skip most of that. I get involved in some of this, and I take too long. But in about 3 weeks after staying there, I got a note, or no, a telephone call from my uncle, and he said, you're supposed to go down to, it's about 4 blocks from the Institute, and go to a shipmaster by the name of Picklick. Why I remembered his name, I'll never know. He got me a job on the Tidewater Oil Company, tankers. My first trip was to Port Arthur, Texas. I drew $10 when I went ashore, and I come back in wee hours in the morning, and the 10 was gone. Now, in those days, it was still bootlegging, of course, and corn whiskey was 25 cents a shot, and so was beer, homemade beer. So that was a lot of drinking. Now, that never changed from that time on. We had a running poker game on the ship at that time. Now, I didn't tell you that we had a mechanic in the National Guard, and when we went to Camp Perry, this fella, I used to help him set up the games and whatnot. I didn't know anything about poker or craps. And so I got to helping him, and I would go to each company at Camp Perry and tell him about the poker game or the crap game we was going to have over at Company G. Now, I didn't know I was a shill. I didn't even know the term. But I did that all the time. And he taught me some things about dice and craps, and I never thought anything of it. But I don't know whether it was in good stand or not. My friends over there, Larry, Big Mouth Larry, and Jerry, they might be able to tell you. But some of us have two things on our back, and that became one. And in those early years, I was just luckier than all get out. I only made $45 a month, but many times I would have double that, you know, and I didn't have enough sense to save any of it. And so I went to sea for 7 months and was coming up the Jersey coast in December the 22nd. And I'll get off of this quick. I had $20 after working 7 months. And I had $20 in a postal savings account in Bayonne, New Jersey. And I'd never been homesick, and all at once, thinking about Christmas and the family, I got terribly homesick. I never experienced that before. And I thought, hell, I ain't got enough money to get home on. And I thought, well, I'll just spend the 20 bucks in that poker game and see if I can do any good. I got in at about 4:30, and at 7:15, I come out of there with $300 and some. That was all the fresh cash on that ship. There's about 40 men. I don't know how many played poker, maybe 20 of them, you know. But I went to the skipper, and I said, hey, how about a trip off? He said, did you hit that poker game? And I said, yeah. So I bought some things and I got on that train, about a round trip ticket on to Pennsylvania. I got into Lima on Christmas Eve. And boy, everything just turned out great. Well, none of my friends were working. And so I put on many parties in the next 10 days. They had a party on New Year's Eve and didn't invite me. And I was there 10 days, and at the end of the 10th day, I was getting on the train and I had to borrow $5 off my mother to have a little change going back. Now, the luck of a drunk. I can remember getting on that train and I said to myself, I'll never get caught dead in this hick town again. That's just the way I felt. Here's the big city boy, you know, wined and dined all these characters, and they had a party and didn't even invite me. I got on that train. It was called the Manhattan Limited. There were 20 cars on there, and they only had one half of a car that was for regular passengers. All the rest were sleepers. There was only one seat, and I got in it. And I'm feeling hungover and bad. And I can't wait until we get out of ways and maybe get a little sleep. The conductor come up with a drunk about that time, and I thought, what the hell? I'm not going to hold still for no drunk. There's the only seat left. They put him in with me. And I thought, if this guy just quivers his lip, I'm going to let him have it. Because he looked like a drunk, although he was well-dressed. I was resting my eyes, and he poked me, and he said, do you like cigarettes? And he had a 20 grand pack carton. Well, 20 grand in those days was cheap. And I thought, now I'm going to get this guy off of me real quick. I said, I got my own cigarettes. He said, maybe you'd like to see mine. And he took the lid off, and there was a narrow bottle of grain alcohol. And he reached down in his little poke and pulled out a sack, and he had 2 pints of Old Overholt, bottled and bond. We became bosom buddies. True story. By the time we got to Pittsburgh, we had drank it up. I didn't know him from Adams, and when I got in there, they were going to have an hour and a half layover, but the Golden Arrow from Detroit was standing on the track, just say like across the cement, and they were waiting on passengers who wanted to get into New York early. And so I gathered my gear and got over there, and I was going up the steps, and the conductor from this other one said, how about your friend? Well, I felt like hell drinking all his whiskey and leaving him. But I went back and got him and put him in a seat, and we both slept. And I got up at 5 o'clock, went to the washroom, shaved, and got ready. In an hour, we was about Philadelphia, in about an hour we'd be into New York. As I was leaving, here come this fella. And he looked pretty good. And he said, are you the guy that took care of me last night? And I said, well, if you want to call it that. He said, I'd like to talk to you when I get through here. And when he got through, he was pretty well-dressed, looks great. He said Roosevelt had been elected President of the United States. He was from the Iroquois Club in Chicago, which is the equivalent of Tammany Hall in New York. He said, I'm the representative of the Iroquois Club to go to New York, and in combination, we were going to get a private train and go to the inauguration. But he said, the last thing I remember, I left my office and stopped into my favorite place to have a drink. And he said, the next thing you know, I'm on that train. He reached in his pocket and he said, I've got plane tickets to New York. He didn't know how he got on there. When we got into New York, he wanted me to come down to City Hall with him, and I wanted to get over to Bayonne and get my $20 out of the bank, which was a very important, you know. I never saw him again. But I'll get off of this. I sailed saltwater for 3 years. I tended bar for 4 years. And then I worked on the railroad for 11. That's the 18 years. After 3 years, I think I had about $75 coming, and that's all I had, and I said that's the end of going to sea, although I love going to sea. I could, waterfront saloons become the habitual place, and I don't think outside of some friends in Staten Island, and they were a godsend. In fact, this fellow's name was Danny Walsh. I was dressed as I thought a sailor should be on my first ship, and I walked out on the poop deck in a turtleneck sweater and one of those blue sailor hats, and a voice, I heard him, there must have been 15 guys out there, and they said, "I'll bet you that's that guy's first trip to sea." And I didn't know what the hell he was talking about, you know. But he embarrassed the hell out of me, because I thought I was dressed like a sailor should be dressed. But, you know, I had a vague idea, that's all. Well, that fellow became a lifelong friend, and he died 2 years ago, Danny Walsh. We remained friends all through those years. And his family was Irish Catholic, and that's the way I had been arranged. And if you stayed in Tom Walsh's house, and you was at Sunday, you went to Mass. That was all there was to it. Anybody that stayed there went to Mass. And so that connection with the church was always fresh because of these friends. One other note, I got a chance to go to San Francisco, and I couldn't wait. Went through the canal. And that trip up the West Coast is a beautiful, if any of you has never made it. Over the Sierras, that sun comes up, and all over that water, for maybe a half a mile out from the shore, is floating turtles. I don't know whether you ever saw that, any of you, but it's the most beautiful sight you'd ever want to see. Thousands of turtles, sea turtles. And I can remember, gee, I'm sure glad I was able to make this trip, you know. And I was thinking about Frisco and what a wonderful time I was going to have. I had $30, which was a lot of money in those days. $30 would get you a lot of places in San Francisco in 1933. I got in there and stopped for a drink 2 blocks from the wharf from the ship. 8 hours later, I walked back to the ship, broke. Yeah, never got to see San Francisco. History of a drunk's life. I quit, went home, got a job with an uncle of mine tending bar, and had a job as a salesman. In a month, I quit the salesman job because I liked the bartending job. I had an uncle, his name was Jeremiah Sullivan. He was an old-time saloon keeper from the before Prohibition, and he was a great guy, big, and he was a good employer. But there was a Bob Sullivan, who was no relation to him, was my fellow bartender, and we worked there a year. We worked a long day and a short day. We go in at 6 o'clock to 12. The other guy would come on from 12 to 6. It became habitual that I would take him to work at 6 in the morning and I'd go to bed. And the next morning he'd take me to work at 6 and he'd go to bed. And so You fellas are not familiar with Lima. In those days, they had two spots on the edge of town, Martin's Tavern and I forget the other. But either one was a 4 o'clock in the morning deal, and that's how it usually was. So there was no let up. I tended bar for 4 years. My father, by this time, was disgusted. Oh, I forgot to tell you, in 1935, after I'd been tending bar, I met Lucky Amy. And before I go any further, I want to tell you that there's two things that happened to me in life. Not only that I was born in the family that I was, but my Amy and AA. I don't want to forget that ever. She says to say hello. She's not in good shape, and she couldn't. She would have liked to have been here, but she couldn't come. Well, I met Amy, and she was a Methodist from a small town of Mendon, Ohio. Mendon, Ohio was strictly, I guess in those days you'd have called it anti-Catholic. But we had been to my house to tell my folks that we was going to get married, and they were trying, what the hell's going on here? This guy is not marriageable material, and they tried to say, hey, no, wait a minute. We wasn't listening, and we went over to her, Mendon, Ohio, which was about 35 miles, and that's Mercer County, and she introduced me to her folks. Now, her mother belonged to the WCTU in the town, and there hadn't been a Catholic in that town for very good reasons for many years, because I don't know whether you knew what they thought of Catholics. The mother asked, what does he do for a living and what church does he go to? She had to tell him that I was a bartender and a Catholic. Well, you know what they prophesied for their daughter. In those days, you couldn't get married in the church proper. You had to get married in the priest's house. And an old friend of mine who I had grown up with, Father Blumens, he was German as all get out, and he married us and sort of shook his head all the time he was marrying us. But anyway, we had three children in 4 years, and Amy found out she really had four children. And I don't know how she did it, but I made her life really hell for the next. I went on the railroad in 39 because my father wanted to get me out of that joints against his better judgment. And I was the first inexperienced railroader in Lima hired on that railroad, and the guy next to me had 12 years seniority. So that was just like finding 12 years seniority. You talk about the luck of the draw. I was never furloughed, but just in passing, we had seniority from Bellevue to Frankfort, Indiana, and then some small railroads in between. And so there was a lot of outside jobs that you could get because nobody wanted them to be away from home. But they seemed attractive to me because I'd be away from home for a week and I wouldn't have to listen to that stuff. And I always said that it was a regular job and I made maybe a third more money because they were long hour jobs. The war was just beginning to come about in the Europe and they needed a lot of. And in about 2 years, I was 40 deep in seniority. So it was the luck of the draw. 11 years, I never really drew a sober breath. And Larry reminded me, and I had forgot this. I worked the Muncie job, and it was about 85 miles from Lima in Indiana. And when we got done on Saturday evening, we could catch the train about midnight and get into Lima about 5 o'clock in the morning. That'd be Sunday morning. And I could spend the day with the family and then catch the train and go back at 9:30 that night. Well, I always used to go over and have a couple of eye-openers about 5:30 at Charlie's place. It seemed like the thing to do, you know. Who would go home and wake up the folks? Well, that became a normal thing until one day I was having so much fun I never went home, and I caught the train back without ever getting home, never seeing my children. And then about 3 weeks later, I did the same thing, and when the train left, I was having so much fun I never got on it. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, I had to hire a cab to take me to Muncie. Now, I don't remember the excuses that I gave Amy. They were readily available, no doubt. And why, I'd have to call her from Indiana and tell her why I never got home. Now, I could go through on with this in various other ways for the next how many years? I had an accident on a railroad, and I won't go into that. No drinking. But I was off 18 months with a crushed foot. I had a good doctor from Portland, Indiana, and he saved not only my life, but my foot. Gangrene set in, and I don't know whether it's too old for, maybe some of the nurses would remember how they used to handle these gangrene cases. But penicillin had come on the market. This was in 1945 or 46. And penicillin saved my life. And I was off 18 months. I got an equitable settlement. I paid everybody off. I hadn't had a drink from the time I got hurt until the time I was getting out of the hospital. I had 3 operations in Cleveland, and the foot became reasonable, and I could walk on it. And it's too long to tell you the whole story. But anyway, after about the third, maybe 2 operations, after the second operation, I was working in a gambling joint. I got myself a job. I didn't have any income. We had 4 children by this time. And we always had plenty of booze in the place for the suckers. And so whether you won or you lost, you was always good for a couple of drinks. And I used to pour them and never think anything of them because I wasn't going to drink. But one day, I guess I had a good day, and I just poured about a half a water glass and downed it and never thought anything of it. And I was back on the races. 3 weeks later, I went in on Sunday morning about 2 o'clock and took all the money in that place and went and got in a crap game and lost something like $450. That was the payoff money for the gamblers the next day. But I was so high, I went home and went to bed, and Amy shook me about 9 o'clock and said, "There's a Ray Cleese is down there with a policeman." I said, "What does he want?" She said, "How would I know?" I went down there, and all at once I tumbled. Hell, I had taken all the money out of that place. And he said he'd like to have his money. I said, "I don't have it. I lost it. But I put a slip in the box there that said that I took it." And he said, "Yes, but I've been down in Florida and just come back, and if I hadn't come back, who's going to pay off?" Well, I thought they were going to take me down, but he had the policeman along for protection, really, because I don't mean that I was a fighter or anything like that, but I never took nothing off of nobody in those days, and so I was quick to. So he brought the cop along because he had to have some assistance. And when I found out that he wasn't going to take me down, I chased them off my front porch. Yeah. When I realized that I wasn't in that kind of trouble, I said, you get off of my front porch. You're embarrassing me with my neighbors. You got no business doing that. Well, anyway, he wanted his keys. I gave him the keys, and I was making $75 a week. I tossed that job away, and we needed every dollar of that. I forget how, you know. Absolutely insane. So I drank from that time on. I had this accident. I got the settlement. I paid everybody off. We were going to buy a home. And I told Amy we better not buy a home because we might move from Lima. Well, she wanted a home the worst way. Well, she held still for it. And in the next 2.5 years, I spent all that money, something like $5,600, which you could buy a home in those days for that kind of money. Well, needless to say, about 1950, she'd had enough of me, and she couldn't get away. And my father's attitude was one of absolute disgust. I used to avoid him like a plague. He got me that job on the railroad, and I avoided him, you can bet. Now, he never saw me. I wasn't a fallen down drunk. You could fill me full of booze, and I could walk a straight line and talk to you. I don't know why. I found out later that some people's livers, metabolize alcohol much quicker than they do normally. And so you throw that off quicker. And so I must have been one of those guys. Because Amy never knew how much I drank. And somebody would ask me, how much does a guy drink if he sits at a stool from 4 p.m. till 4 a.m? He wasn't making conversation. And I can recall many, many mornings at 4 o'clock ordering another drink in an after hours joint and saying to myself, why in the hell don't you go home? But I didn't know I was alcoholic. But anyway, I wind up really broke. Everything's gone. We'd been living in a rental house. And Amy, she would have been long gone if she'd had any money. I went over to see my father, or my mother. I ran right into my father. Now, I hadn't done anything to him. I hadn't said nothing to him. I hadn't seen him for maybe 2 months. And he opened the front door when I knocked. I thought he was working. And he said to me in a rage, he said, I don't know what I've ever done to God that he'd send me a son like you. And I said, well, I'll see you later. And I got out of there. Now, about 2 months later, my brother was a Jesuit priest. He joined the Jesuit order in 1935, the same time I got married. So we celebrate these years together anymore. And if Amy and I are both alive on May the 23rd, we'll celebrate 65 years of marriage. Now, those of you who don't know Amy, and there's not too many do here. There's quite a few at that. But she was a lovely lady and a lovely girl. And I just thank God every day. Now, I'm the chief provider of everything in the home today, and I'm tickled to death to do that. At one time, in the drinking days, I couldn't have cared less. In fact, when I got into the program, she had been saying about if I could get out of here, you know, I'm going to divorce you. I'd say, you know, why in the hell don't she do something about it and quit harping about it? I couldn't have cared less what she did at the end of my drinking. My brother called from Cleveland and said he was coming in about 4 days. I said, well, I'll see you. He's going to play golf. We all grew up on a golf course, so we all played golf. He came in, but payday was like on Saturday, and I got the check. And he was to come in Monday. Well, I didn't go home Sunday night. And I opened up a bar in an alley about 5:30 in the morning. And I was sitting there, and at 9 o'clock I come to. And I thought, Joe's... called Amy. And she told him, I haven't been home for 2 days. What am I going to tell him? I sit there all day. Couldn't think of a lie. And at 5 o'clock, I called my mother's house and asked for Joe. And I told Joe, how about picking me up? And he picked me up in Lima there in front of the Roxy, which was the joint. And he picked me up, and I took him. I didn't know where to go. I took him to an after-hours joint out on Northwest Street, about 2 miles out. The place was a shack. Inside, it wasn't bad, but outside, a fellow by the name of Mike M. ran it. And I was a regular there, so you get away with a lot of things. There was nobody in the place. He was just cleaning up and getting ready for the... Well, a friend of mine runs it, and it's a good place. We get in there, and I tried to explain to him why I wasn't there that morning to play golf with him, and I found out that he forgot about it. He never even thought about playing golf. He didn't know nothing. And here I am trying to think of a big lie. I finally broke down in those crocodile tears, and I don't think I ever cried that I can remember. And I told him what was happening to me. And he took me home about 7:30 and let me out, and he said, Tom, maybe something good will come out of this. And I can remember walking to the door, and what the hell's the matter with that fellow? What does he mean, something good will come out of this? Well, I didn't know that you should get a drunk talking. And if you can get him to relieve himself of all this mess that he's in, maybe he might listen to some kind of reason. And I got a letter from him in 2 weeks suggesting I come to Cleveland to make a retreat. And I thought, what the hell do I want to go to Cleveland to make a retreat for? I didn't know what a retreat was. I knew my father went to some in Cincinnati, but I didn't. Well, the more I thought about it, I thought, hell, I ain't got no money, I ain't got no car. I'd have a car for 3-4 months, and the way I'd go for 4 or 5 days to Chicago or Detroit and come out and be so stripped and broke, I'd have to sell the car. Yes, I don't know how many times. So sometimes I had a car, and I was probably the highest paid man on that Nickel Plate Railroad because I worked all the long hard jobs. I can remember looking in my time book one time, and I'd worked 80 hours a week for 2 years and never had a vacation and didn't have a dime. Those guys that followed me on that board, in about 3 or 4 years, all of them had 2 cars in the garage and homes of their own, and I didn't have nothing. Well, I got to thinking about that retreat, and I thought, hey, if I go to that retreat, maybe I'll get the family off my back. And I thought, how in the hell am I going to get any money or a car? The only guy, I didn't have no friends left, and so I thought, hell, I can't go ask my dad for his. But I thought that's the only way. So I went over and asked him. He was on the porch. I'm down here. I said, hey, Dad, Joe invited me up to Cleveland to make a spiritual retreat. And I thought maybe if you didn't mind, I'd use your car. Oh, no. No, he said. No, that ain't such a good idea. And I said, well, I agree with you. That's okay. And I started down the street and up the sidewalk. Come back here. I stopped. He just took those keys and threw them to about the distance of this room and said, take the damn thing. Well, I had to borrow $15 someplace. And you know, to this day, I don't know where I borrowed it. I mean, I'm sure that I must have paid somebody back, because I went around and paid people back that I didn't know. Really. But it was on my conscience. I can remember one saloon keeper. I made him take 15 bucks. I said, I owe 15 bucks to somebody. I said, please take it. I've been haunted with this in my first couple of years of sobriety. So he said, well, if you insist. I said, give it to your favorite charity, you know, that sort of thing. So I wasn't too smart up here. But anyway, I went to that retreat. I had to pick out, and it was over the Memorial holiday, because I could do that without losing too much work over the holiday. I got up there, went in. My brother wasn't available. I asked somebody to page him or something, and they did, and he came over, and I hadn't told anybody I was coming. I never made a reservation, because I didn't know you had to do that, or you're supposed to do it. But he was surprised to see me. He said, why didn't you call or something? I said, I never thought about it. We sit down to supper, and there's a great big Irishman sitting on his right, and I was on his left. And I wasn't hungry either. And I'll tell you the truth, it was a lousy meal. Really, there was a brother, Doubt. He was the cook. We got to be great friends, but he was a lousy cook. My brother Joe found out that the guy next to him was the captain of this retreat, and I had stumbled into an AA retreat. Well, my brother, in 47 or 48, before he got ordained, got mad at me when he come to town one time, and he just said, what the hell's the matter with you? Said, you don't have any idea how many rosaries your father and mother say for you. And I said, well, what do they do that for? Well, you know, I knew. So those rosaries kicked in. In the next 3 days, that got permission. It was a silent retreat, but they got permission to talk to me at night. And they did. And so I didn't know anything about AA, never heard of it. They sent me a name. The name they sent was George Skinner. George Skinner was a guy that had a big grocery out in the 400 class. He used to come to those joints where I worked as a bartender, and he'd stick around for maybe a day or 2 days. We had rooms upstairs, and he'd be all dressed up, and about the second day, I'd call his wife. He'd be passed out in the booth, and she'd wait until dark. And we'd take him by the feet and the head and carry him out and throw him in the back end. And I said to Mrs. Skinner, don't bring him back, you know. The name I got in the mail was George Skinner. Hell, I hadn't seen him for 15 years. He came out to see me, and he took me to my first AA meeting in Findlay, Ohio. Well, I've been coming ever since, as you know. I stayed in Lima for 16 years, became part of the thing. Had enough money in 1951 to take a long, we were 16 years married and never had a honeymoon. So I took her to New York. At the end of 5 years, we had enough money to go to St. Louis for the second international. And that's a story, another story that I haven't got time to tell you. I met Dick Caron, who I had written. He started Chit Chat Farms up in Pennsylvania. But when I met him, he was sending letters called Chit Chat to loners all over the world. He come from a family with a lot of money, so he could do this. And then 5 years later, we met him in St. Louis at his suggestion. And he took me to a private party of about 45 people, a dinner he put on, of AAs from all over the world. South Africa, Kwaling Islands. There's a fellow named Jack Hartley. I forget about him. In the early days, the Grapevine, he had in there an article, God, the Big Book, and Me, and I. And they featured that for many years. And then he moved to San Francisco, and we corresponded. And he must have died because it died out. But I got an entirely different picture of AA through this international. And Dick Caron and I remained friends until he died. He died about the same time that Bill Wilson did. I met Bill Wilson at Founders Day, 1953. I had taken a carload to Akron, and it was a one-day affair, and they met in Goodyear Theater. And I had these three guys, and I took them up to the St. Thomas's to show them the place, because I had sent a man, had taken a man there. And they said, why don't you go in the basement? They got cookies and cake and anything you want down there. So we went down, and about 20 minutes later, here come Bill Wilson and Lois. And he sat there for an hour and a half and told us about the early days and how he had attempted to screw up this thing. And it was, he said, thank God for Dr. Bob, because if he hadn't been around, I'd have had this thing in the hole a long time ago. But he was a great guy and easy to talk with. And when I went to St. Louis, I was invited to a party one night in the suite. I said to Amy, are you going to go? And she said, I've had a full day. I'm going to bed. So I went in, and it was packed like this. Two rooms or three rooms. And there was a little settee there about the size of this table. And I sat down there. That was the only place left. And about 5 minutes later, who walked in but Bill Wilson, and sat right down beside me. It was the last seat in there. And somewhere, from an outfit in Jersey, we're on a tape following each other. Only claim to fame. Now, Bill Wilson didn't remember me from the Akron thing, but I told him I had seen him and was there, but he remembered being there. And so it was a delightful 30 minutes there. I've had some wonderful times in the program. I was the secretary of my group. I come back and I became the, what do you call the first thing in the program? I became, GSR. Right, group representative, GSR. So that's my only claim to fame and going up the steps. I went up the steps halfway, and I found out that if I stayed there, I was going to become a delegate, so I resigned. Truth, I just never wanted to be a delegate. You know, I haven't got time to tell you about all the great guys, especially, say, like in the friendship group. Russ there. Russ just found out what he's been missing here lately. He won a flower. He won the 50-50. He's going to start making more of these things. He didn't know how good this was, did you, Russ? I thought maybe Bill... If you let Bill win one, you know. Huh? Well, I don't know for sure. We'll ask him after the meeting. But I met Joe, Jack Ditter, Bob Nine, Tom Wine, Bob Carpenter, all those fellows. Oh, Cecil. Cecil worked at the Reynoldsburg sewage disposal. And I became his sponsor. So a lot of times I'd just go out there and spend 2 or 3 hours with him after midnight, because he was lonesome out there. And those, if you never met Cecil, you should have. He said, "One thing about this job, Tom, is that I learned you should never bite your fingernails." He was something. The story. He always told the story about the yellow canary. I have always loved this story. It's about the guy that had went through the mill, lost his family, everything, and he living in 2 rooms, and he was sober in the program. Going to the meetings, and the fellow said, he told the fellow that he was lonely, and the guy said, "Why don't you get yourself a pet?" He said, "That's not such a bad idea," he said. He said, "I've always wanted a yellow canary, one that can sing." So he told this guy, he said, "You don't have to worry about that. You go down to that pet shop, and that guy's got all kinds of canaries. He'll fix you up." Well, he said, "I don't have a whole lot of money." He said, "You tell him." He went down to that guy and asked about a yellow canary, and he said, "I got a great one. Brother, he can beat any bird singing." Well, he said, "Trot him out." He said, "There's only one hitch." Said, "He's got an impediment on his beak." And he said, "Every once in a while, you have to sort of chisel that down. But you have to be very careful, because if you would break through and make a hole there when he took a drink, he might drown himself." He said, "But you don't have to worry about that if you just follow instructions." He said, "I'll give it to you for practically nothing." He said, "You go down to the hardware there. A friend of mine, he's got those, what do you call it, files." He said, "He knows the right file to give you." He went down, got the file, went home. 2 weeks went by. He was walking down the street, and there was this guy from the hardware and the pet owner standing on the corner talking. And he was across the street, and they saw him, and they said, "Hey, how are you getting along?" "Fine." Said, "How's the canary?" "Oh, he died. We told you about not fine." "He didn't die that way." "Well, how did he die?" He said, "He was dead when I took him out of the vise." Folks, I left Lima. Boy, we're way over. I left Lima in 1966 and got sweet talked into giving up a lifetime job. I was the seventh oldest man on 500-mile railroad, and gave it up to go to Chicago and be a big timer. I was there 4 years and I had to quit. That's how I got into Columbus. How it works is, had a lot of friends had horses. And even though I was sober, we used to go to the harness races. This fella had a horse going in Chicago. I'd been down to the bookie and put a $2 daily double in and got a limit parlay, $240, I think, whatever that was. So a bunch of us went to Chicago. We went to Chicago and was at Washington Park. We used to do this about every 2 months. We'd leave about 3:30, get there at 7:30, be at the races until midnight, and 4 hours back, never thought anything of it. And Amy was tickled to death that I didn't drink, so she didn't mind that I went, because she knew I was in fairly good company. And so we went up there that day, and that horse broke out of the gate, and he was 8 lengths ahead of everything. And the park, Washington Park, was a mile track. And when he got around to the stretch, which is, a long way, that stretch, that horse saw that stretch, and he just quit. And he walked in. I'm not exaggerating. And brother, you talk about a bunch of... But I got to thinking. Maybe sometime I'll come up without anybody and I'll stay over. I ought to get a name out of the directory. So I looked in the directory in Chicago, and there I found him, Don Murphy, an Irishman, of course. Telephone number. Put it in my pocket, my wallet. This was about 1958. Forgot all about it. Never did any such thing. But moved into Chicago in an apartment. And when we got settled, like I was telling you we did here, thought, I wonder if I still got that number in my wallet. And it was old and scraggly, but I could make out the numbers, and I called, and he lived 1 mile from me in Chicago. In North Riverside. And I called him, and the next night we went to a meeting. And he got me so involved in them west suburbs that a woman's halfway house, Father Mack down on Skid Row, which was the Holy Cross Mission, two other meetings. So I was full of AA meetings the first week. With no, I didn't do nothing. I just had kept that number. And Don Murphy and I became close because he was involved in many ways. Oh, that's too long to tell you that story. Anyway, then I quit and come down here. I called, first night I was in here, I called Joe Thomas, and what happened? Friendship. I ran a, 2 months after I was here, I became manager of a warehouse. Had a lot of time. It was never interfered with any of my AA activities. And I'll tell you one more story and I'll quit. Joe Thomas, Jack Ditter, myself, Howard Wilson, Tom Wine, and others, Paul, Luke at times, but them regulars. We used to, after the Friday night meeting, we used to go to Howard Wilson's. And he'd put on him, he had a pool table in the basement. And so he'd put on a cold lunch. And he always had all the best. We got to growling about his pool table because there was a post there that would interfere with your swing. So he laid off 1 week. And when we went back, he had a brand new pool table, and he had taken that post out. You remember? Jack Ditter. The first year at Friendship, Bob Nine brought sandwiches every meeting night. And after a year, Jack Ditter got tired of the menu, and he complained, and so Nine gave him the privilege of bringing this. And after 1 month, we were back to donuts and coffee. Donuts and coffee. But we had a lot of fun. I was connected with a woman's halfway house there in Chicago, and I've told this story before, and I'll tell it and quit. I'd go back about every 2 months to Chicago and meet my old friends and maybe go to a couple of meetings and come back, and it was generally, I went by myself. I didn't take Amy, and she didn't care to make that kind of a trip. So I went up on a Saturday night. I used to be in charge of that meeting on Saturday night, and it was in the western suburbs, but on a sort of a cross where the black and white, what do you call that? That's that way, but the whites were moving out and blacks were moving in. Nothing wrong with that, except that most of the support for the Grateful House came from the west suburbs. And we would always want those ladies from them big houses to come in and talk to the people that were at the house. So we had a tough time for a while. And I used to go down on the corner of Washington and whatever the street was that the house was on and wait, and they would drive in and I'd take them down and get them parked and whatnot. And I was close by so I could go over at noon many times. And I always give those ladies a 24-hour book. Anybody that went through, I gave a 24-hour book. Well, I went back to take a visit. I called Norm Peters, who was the president of our board, and he said, why don't you come to the house and we'll go over to Grateful House tonight and make a meeting. I said, I can't do it that way. I'll just meet you at Grateful House. So I did, and a young lady was talking that night. And she had a nice story. And halfway through her story, she said, I've got a 24-hour book here, and I'll read you what it says inside. To Nancy from Tom D. And he's in the audience tonight. And I was surprised because I didn't remember her. And she was one of those girls, and she'd been sober now about 3 years. Well, I come back, and it was 1972, December, Friendship's anniversary. And they were kidding me and saying, well, we've had two speakers for our anniversary. You're from the big town. Why don't you get us a big town speaker? Well, I got to thinking about Nancy. So I called her, and she said she'd come down. Her father was a cop, and she belonged to a cop group up there. And that cop group, four of them, drove down, and I flew her down. We didn't know they were coming. And I don't know whether any of you remember Bill Woods. It's a wonder I can remember his name. It's been a while. But Bill Woods had a party for all this gang at his house afterward. And we was out till about 4 in the morning. And these four fellas had driven down to see that she didn't get in any trouble because it was her first sojourn out of Chicago. While they were there, she said, Tom, these fellows have formed a group that go on trips, AA trips. And they've got one coming up in 73 that's going to Ireland for Ireland's 27th anniversary. And so, what was the fellow's name, the little guy? Frank Giddens. Frank Giddens, he got all excited about this, and so before it was over, 12 of us went to Chicago and got on a plane with 185 more and went to Ireland for their 27th, and we had a great time. I still got the brochure. 5 days, plane fare, lodging, two meals, $250. Yes. Yes. I made copies of it just recently, and I sent it to my friends that have this idea about going to Ireland. But we were there 5 days. We come back. All through just the fact the group says get a big time lead. She's a great girl. I believe she's still sober. I haven't heard from quite a number of years now. And I don't know about those fellows. One by one, they've been dying off on me in Chicago, and I called two numbers here in the last 6 months, and they're both not in order anymore. So my friends, most of them were older than I were. But I've had a wonderful time in the program. I would say this, I haven't talked about the program much, but I know this, that the 12 steps and the 12 traditions, and if you don't drink, and especially you new folks, if there's any here, which were, there was a few, it works in strange ways. All I know is that I'm doing this, I did the same thing you're trying to do now. And in short order, the program asked us in the 12 steps to work on ourselves and then to function for the good of others. And they were smart enough to give us the 12 steps. And briefly, the first step, we are helpless and hopeless. And the second step, we ask that God give us the strength to stay sober. And in the third step, all you have to do is place yourself in His hands. It's as simple as that. The rest will come. If you don't drink and you do come, now I don't mean that you're going to, from now on, don't drink and come to meetings and that's all there is to it. That isn't true. There's a lot more here, but it'll come within the premise that God wants you to know. I want to thank all of you for listening. It's been a good thing for me to come here and for to see all my old friends and wish you well. And thank you again for asking.